I want to spend part of this meditation time teaching you this mantra. This mantra is Dakshinamurti, and it's something that we chanted a lot in India, but also we chanted it to bring in the new year in front of the Dakshinamurti idol that we have at the ashram. And it's a really beautiful chant. What it says is beautiful, and so it's a mantra that you can use for japa. It's a little bit long for japa, but it's still something that you can repeat over and over and over again. And also the sankalpa is a beautiful sankalpa. Okay, so I thought I'd teach it to you. So let's take a look at it. It doesn't really have swaras, but I'll just teach it to you as we chanted it. Okay. First, just repeat after me, and I'll tell you what it means, and then we'll start the chant. Om Namo Bhagavate.
Om Namo Bhagavate.
Dakshinamurtaye.
Dakshinamurtaye.
Mahyam Shriyam.
Mahyam Shriyam.
Medham Pragnam.
Medham Pragnam.
Prayacha.
Prayacha.
Swaha.
Swaha.
It says, Om Namaha. My salutations, my prostrations, Bhagavate, dative singular, to the Lord, to Bhagawan. So, Om Namo Bhagavate, salutations to the Lord, Bhagawan. Dakshinamurtiye, to Lord Dakshinamurti. Lord Dakshinamurti is really the deity that blesses all of the Arsavidya Gurukulams, because Dakshinamurti is a form of Shiva. It means in every one of the Arsavidya Gurukulam, we have Dakshinamurti as our idol there. Is the deity, the Murti, that's there. So Dakshinamurti, Swamiji chose Dakshinamurti because Dakshinamurti is the first incarnation of Shiva, is the first teacher. And so the Dakshinamurti, if you see the Murti at the ashram or any Dakshinamurti, will have the Chin Mudra. You know, this is the Chin Mudra. Everybody's probably seen this at some point or another. This Chin Mudra is really the whole Vedanta, where these three fingers are body, mind, sense organs, the upadis, the jiva upadis. This is the ahankara, right? This is the samsari here. That's the samsari mudra. This is Brahman. This is Brahman. So the chin mudra is when the ahankara, right, resolves into Brahman, is identified with Brahman, not with the upadis. And so the Dakshinamurti, then I think the hand is like this welcoming for protection, welcoming and protection. And then this Chin Mudra, you know, which really is the whole vision there, right? This is what happens. This is a jnani, is the one whose ahankara now is resolves into Brahman, is identified with Brahman, not with the upadis. And so Dakshinamurti is the first teacher. There'll often be pictures of Dakshinamurti sitting with the students surrounding him. Mm. And Dakshina is the one who faces
south.
The one who faces south. The one who's facing death. Right? The one who faces death, and all the students are facing north to facing the Lord. You know, for moksha, for freedom from death, freedom from samsara, freedom from bondage. So Dakshinamurti is really the deity that often we pray to. Mm. So here,
Swamiji also said because north attracts.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I haven't heard him say that, but that makes sense too. So here, Om Namo Bhagavate Dakshinamurtiye. So Om, my salutations to the Lord, Dakshinamurti. Then, Mahim, to me, Prayacha, may you give to me, may you grant me. Prayacha is an imperative case. May you grant me Shriyam, wealth. Shriyam means prosperity, it means wealth, it's for Lakshmi. Wealth in terms of health, in terms of prosperity, in terms of overall well-being. May I be protected in samsara, really. May my life be protected in samsara. May I be healthy. May I have security in my family. May I have all the wealth I need to survive. So Shriyam, Medham. May I have a good memory. May I be able to retain. Medham means that ability of the intellect to retain knowledge. To remember what you learn is medha shakti. Shakti means that power of medha, that power of memory. So here, Shriyam, may I be protected in terms of my prosperity and health. Medham, may I have the ability to remember what I learn. That's medha. Pragnam is wisdom. Pragnam means knowledge. So please give me prayacha. May you give me, may you grant me, to me, mahyam, to me, dative case, may you grant to me these three things, shriyam, medham, pragnam, right? Swaha. Now, when we did this at the ashram, there were many people, each had their own little, almost like a little puja table was set up, for there must have been 100 people with a little small puja set up. And we would, as they would chant, you know, then when they'd say swaha, they would offer flowers. So when you say the swaha, it's you make the sankalpa and then you offer flowers to the Lord. So you can do that mentally. It's just a pranams or a namaskara to the Lord. And so that's what swaha, like if you see them do a Vedic ritual when they're pouring the ghee in, they'll say, pour the ghee and say swaha, like that, you know. So that's what that swaha is. So let's let everybody understand the mantra. So let's look at it. Can repeat after me. Om namo bhagavate. Om namo bhagavate. Dakshinamurtaye. Dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham. Mahim shriyam medham. Prajnam priyacha. Prajnam priyacha. Swaha.
Swaha.
Om namo bhagavate. Dakshina murtaye. Mahim shriyam medham. Prajnam priyacha. Swaha. Om namo bhagavate. Dakshina murtaye. Om namo bhagavate. Dakshina murtaye. Mahim shriyam medham. Mahim shriyam medham. Prajnam priyacha swaha. Prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham. Prajnam priyacha swaha. Mahim shriyam medham. Prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Let's do it together for a while. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. Mahim shriyam medham prajnam priyacha swaha. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtaye. beautiful chant. Ready, Bhadram? Om Bhadram Karne Vishvinu Yama Devaha Bhadram Pashye Makshabhir Yajatraha Stirai Rangai Istushtuvagum Sastanubihi Yashema Devahitam Yadayuhu Swastina Indro Vrittashravaha Swastina Pusha Vishwavedaha Swastina Starcho Arishtanemihi Swastino Brahaspatirtadatu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. We're on verse 1 of this chapter 2. I'm not sure that what page is it, in 52 or something? 58? Avisannihitam guhacharam Avisannihitam guhacharam Nama mahatpadam atraithat samarpitam Nama mahatpadam atraithat samarpitam Ejat pranan nimishatcha Ejat pranan nimishatcha Yaretat janata Sarasat Varenyam, Sarasat Varenyam, Param Vignanat, Param Vignanat, Yadvarishtam Prajanam, Yadvarishtam Prajanam. Abhihi Sannihitam Guha Charam Nama Mahatpadam Atra Etat Samarpitam Ejat Pranat Nimishat Cha Yat Etat Janata Sat Asat Varenyam Param Vignanat Yet Varishtam Prajanam. This section now is going to unfold in yet another way. And the Upanishads are like this. It'll unfold the vision in one way using certain prakriyas, certain methodologies to make you see. And then it will come back and unfold it again using different prakriyas, different methodologies to make you understand, to help you to understand. And that's the whole teaching methodology, actually, is to unfold the swarupa, unfold your nature in innumerable ways. Right, so that you can see it from so many different angles. You're seeing the same thing over and over again. Right, it's the same vision over and over again, but seeing it from different angles, using different logics, different understandings to make you see the same thing. That's why Swamiji once said, teaching Vedanta, you have to be very creative. It's kind of like an elephant trying to do a dance on a little stump. You know, because the vision itself is so small. You are Brahman. Right? You are Brahman. That's the vision. You are Brahman. Now we have to make you see that. in a whole bunch of different ways. So just imagine a great big elephant dancing on a little stump, creatively.
Looks like that Garampati there when we come in.
That's right. Okay. So, here, this section now is being begun with a certain unfoldment. And Shankara says, you know, the Akshara Brahman means that Akshara Brahman which is Sat, pure being. It's Akshara. It's something indestructible, changeless, free from any type of change. And it's Arupam. It has no form. It's free from change, indestructible, and it's Arupam. It has no form, therefore very subtle. So Shankara introduces this as, how can that Akshara, in what manner, Kena Prakarena, in what way, by what methodology, in what manner, in what way can this be known, Vijnanam? Can this Akshara Brahman, which has no form, so you can't see it, you can't say, oh, look at Brahman over there, because Brahman has no form. So how can this Brahman, which has no form, which is free from time, free from change, how can it be known? What is the methodology there? So that's how Shankara introduces this section. So in this verse, he says, starts out with avihi. Avihi means that which is self-evident, self-effulgent, prakasham. So that Brahman, the whole verse is about Brahman. Brahman is avihi. It is something which is self-manifest. By self-manifest means, better word is prakasham, is what Shankara used. Prakasham means light. It is consciousness itself. Right? Consciousness itself. If it's consciousness itself, no other consciousness need come in to light it up. You don't need consciousness to be aware of consciousness. This is extremely important. The whole vision rests on this understanding, in fact. If the self-evident nature of consciousness isn't understood, then there's no way for you to gain knowledge of consciousness, because your pramanas, the means of knowledge that you have available for you, you're dependent on those pramanas, those means of knowledge, to gain knowledge of something out here. And then I, as a conscious being, illumine that object. And therefore that object, using the pramana, that object is known. Okay. Brahman has no form. Brahman is not an object. It is free from change. It is non-objectifiable. And therefore, it can't be known by any of my sense organs. This is later in the verse it'll say this. It can't be known by any sense perception because it's not an object of sense perception. And if it can't be known by sense perception, it can't be known by any type of inference or presumption or any of the other comparison or any of the other means of knowledge that we have available to us. Because all of these means of knowledge that you have as an individual available to you are meant to perceive the world, to experience the world in a subject-object relationship, right? So I am aware of this, therefore this becomes known. And this becomes known through my sense organs, which give me a thought modification true to that object. That's how I gain knowledge. If Brahman is not objectifiable, and is not an object, has no form, how on earth can I know it? This has been so very misunderstood in this Neo-Vedanta or the New Age. Because in the Neo-Vedanta or the, I won't want to call it Neo-Vedanta, I don't want to associate Vedanta with it, but with a New Age type of thinking, is that the problem they have is exactly this. That the self is infinite, it is non-objectifiable, it is beyond, it transcends the creation, all of these type of words. And therefore, it cannot be known by the sense organs in the mind. Therefore, what do? We have to shut down the sense organs and the mind. Right? We have to withdraw the sense organs in the mind, we have to shut down the sense organs and the mind, and then somehow we will know it. There's some sort of a logic like that, right? Because it can't be known by the mind or the sense organs. Right? So then what are you going to do? If Brahman can't be known by the mind and the sense organs, then what do you have to do? Well, you have to get rid of them. And then somehow, then somehow you will know. This is the type of thinking. But there's a certain logic to the thinking, right? There's a reason that people think that way. It's because that's logical within the context of which they're thinking, because they haven't been taught this particular alternative, this particular way of understanding. If Brahman, which is non-objectifiable and is not an object to be perceived by your sense organs, but it itself is consciousness, and let me put it like this. If Brahman is the Atma, which it is, the whole Mahavakya is Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Right? So that means that Brahman is the self. To put it more clearly, Brahman is yourself. Brahman is yourself, and it is Avihi. Avihi means prakasham. It is consciousness itself. If it's consciousness itself, we use Sanskrit term for that, swaprakashitvam. It is self-luminous. It is swaprasiddham, self-evident. Why do we use these terms, self-luminous, self-evident? Because the self-experience, the I experience, does not require sense perception for it to be known. That's what we mean by self-evident. It doesn't require a knower to know it. It doesn't require knower known, a knower known relationship in order for it to shine. The example that we use for this, and this is why avihi and words like prakasham, which means light, are often used, surya, the sun, it's often used as an illustration to make you understand the swaprakashatvam, the self-luminosity of your being. So we say the sun. Does the sun have to light be lit up for it to shine? Right? Do you have to light up the sun for the sun to be seen? That's the example. Do you have to bring in another luminary to light up the sun for the sun to be seen? You would say, no, of course we don't. Why? Because the sun is its own has its own luminosity. You see that? The sun is its own luminosity. No other light can come and make any difference to that luminosity. It is the luminosity itself. Okay? So now for consciousness, does another consciousness need to come in to make consciousness shine? To make consciousness be consciousness? No. That's why we say consciousness is self-evident. Now, to understand this further, when we do meditation, for instance, if you notice what you do is you withdraw all of your sense perception and you quieten your mind. You just withdraw. You quieten your mind. You relax. You turn inward. Your being is what is left when you do that process, right? When your sense organs are looking out at the world, you're experiencing all name and form and color and sound, etc. When you shut that down, now, if I just close my eyes, relax, now I'm experiencing the thought flow in my mind. Okay? My eyes are open. I am here experiencing this world. Clear? I am here, my own being, experiencing the world. If I shut my eyes, now I am here experiencing the sense of touch, any sense of sound, no sight. But I am still here. If I bring my consciousness in further, my mind in further, into further relaxation, say I decide to just focus on the thoughts in my mind, now what is the situation? I am here illumining the thoughts in my mind. Right? Everybody should know this experience in meditation. Okay? Now say we do japa, the repetition of a mantra. Om Namah Shivaya, 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 silence. And I do that for long enough until even the thought flow stops. And then what? I am here. And then what? Silence. So I am here. And there is silence. It's not a perception taking place. Right? Now I make that mind into more of a mirror just focused on awareness, so that the mirror of the mind is just absorbed. What is the experience? I am here. My mind is absorbed. All the way through, I am here. Okay? That I am here, that presence, is what we mean by self-evident, self-effulgent. There is nothing illumining that presence. That presence illumines everything else. So now, because Brahman is myself, is that presence, I do not require sense organs to recognize it. Rather, the recognition, the self-recognition, the self-experience, the self-evident nature of my being is already there. It is never not there. Whether you have ignorance, whether you're ignorant, you don't know yourself, or you know yourself, it makes no difference. Makes no difference. In terms of the self-evident nature of my being as a conscious being. And that's the bottom line. And so now, this recognition that the self is the self which is Brahman is avihi, is self-evident. Now there becomes a teaching methodology to help me differentiate this avihi, this self-evident being of myself, from all of the things that I have superimposed it upon and all of the things that have been superimposed on it. So now I have to recognize, okay, this self-evident presence, which is myself, what is its nature? The first thing, it starts with avihi. First thing, it is self-evident. Brahman is self-evident as your being, as the Atma. It is self-evident, avihi. Okay? Second thing he says, sannihitam, it is avihi, it is self-evident, swaprakasha, self-luminous, and it is sannihitam. It is the most close. It is the most near. Sannihitam means very near. It is very near. Why? Because you're going to recognize that Brahman, which is avihi, self-swaprakasha, is your being. There is nothing more near. Because you're going to recognize that that sannihitam Brahman, which is avihi, is your own being, is the Atma. So that Brahman starts out like this. This Brahman, which is self-evident, is sannihitam. It is most near. Where is it? Guhacharam. It is moving around in the guha. Guha means the cave, but it means buddhi. It's that which is moving in the buddhi. Buddhi means the intellect. In which way is it moving around? Because actually, Brahman doesn't move. Brahman doesn't move. Right? It's free. It's non-objectifiable. It's free from change. So consciousness doesn't move. It doesn't waver around. However, the buddhi, your mind, is always moving around. And your mind is never apart from consciousness. When your mind is there, like I say, we won't deal with deep sleep. So when your mind is awake, one quality of the mind is that it is conscious. Right? As long as the mind is there, it is conscious. The vrittis, the thought modifications, keep going one after another after another after another. One thought after another thought after another thought. You're hearing sounds, you're seeing sights, you're thinking thoughts, you're feeling emotions. All of these, this activity, all of this movement is going on in the buddhi. And that movement that is going on in the form of all of the manifest thoughts are not away from consciousness. Right? So the buddhi completely enjoys consciousness. Try to remove any thought, whether it be a good thought or a bad thought or a beautiful thought or an ugly thought. Try to remove it or separate it from consciousness. You can't do it. Right? As long as the thought is there, that thought enjoys consciousness. But this is important. So, guhacharam. This Brahman, avihi, the conscious, the self-consciousness, is there moving around in the buddhi. Okay? We have to do a little more on this, but let's look at it like this. From the standpoint of the buddhi itself, with all of the thoughts, it is moving around. Right? Because the thoughts are moving around. The thoughts have themselves, this is what you have to understand, the thoughts themselves have no being apart from consciousness. So we can say these thoughts themselves are consciousness, right? Because they have no substance, no being at all, apart from consciousness. See that? The difference is, so we can say, all of the thoughts that are moving around in the mind, all of them have consciousness. They're not away from consciousness. Consciousness is their very substance. They are consciousness. You can say that. But then you have to say, but consciousness is not them. They are consciousness. Because they have no being, no substance apart from consciousness. But consciousness is not them because the thoughts come and go. And the consciousness remains a substrate. The consciousness remains as the very being, the self-evident being, in which all of these thoughts, this knowledge, we can say now, Swamiji will say it like this now, all of these thoughts, this knowledge is manifesting. Right? It's manifesting and manifesting and manifesting and manifesting. Consciousness is not manifesting. Right? Consciousness is the same, so it stays the same. So we can say, these thoughts are manifestations of consciousness, but the consciousness remains the same. What we have a word for this in the Sanskrit. It's called Vivarta Upadana Karanam. Upadana Karanam means the material cause. What if I say consciousness, the avihi, that being, the me, the consciousness, is the material cause, the very substance of the thought, like the clay is the substance of the pot. Right? Clay is the substance of the pot. Consciousness is the substance of the thought. Right? It's the clay of the thought. It's the substance of the thought. But the difference between consciousness and the thought and clay and the pot is what we call vivarta. Vivarta means the consciousness is the substance of the thought, but it undergoes no change to become the thought. It's kind of like the example that we can use is how the rope undergoes no modification, no change to become the snake. Right? But there is no snake apart from the rope. There is really only rope there. But the rope manifests as a snake because of Maya, with Maya. It manifests as a snake. But rope doesn't change at all. And yet rope is the material cause of the snake because it has no other material cause. It has no other being. So now, here in your experience with the mind, this guha, guhacharam, you see the consciousness becoming thought after thought after thought after thought after thought, perceptions, moods, emotions, etc. That's true. But the consciousness doesn't go through any modification to become those things. That's the relationship that you have to understand. And you understand that not just intellectually, but you understand it experientially. You understand it experientially like in this way. By just simply sitting and watching your thoughts. When you watch your thoughts, right? What I mean by that is just to sit and be aware of the thought flow. This is exactly what you experience. You experience a stable consciousness and changing thoughts. You experience a stable consciousness and thoughts that come and go. Right? Then you try in your mind. You say, can I remove the thought from consciousness? Can I have the thought and have the thought not be conscious? Is it possible? Say, no, it's not possible. Can I say, does this thought have any being apart from consciousness? Does it have any separate reality apart from consciousness? Say no, because there's no way that you can have that experience of taking the thought away from the consciousness and having the thought still be there. The thought will go. But that's the trick. The thought will go and the consciousness remains. Now, why japa is so important to do the repetition of the mantra is because when you repeat a mantra and go through that process of breaking the associative thinking, what you recognize there is that the consciousness, which is the very substance of the thought, is stable as the thought is taking place. You just have to quiet down your mind a little bit to recognize that relationship, that there's a changeless consciousness which the mind is totally dependent on for its being, but which itself never changes. That's an extremely important relationship. Japa helps you to understand that relationship. And what it helps you to see is there's two things here, both in these first words, avihi. It helps you to see, okay, avihi. My being is not being lit up. My being is the light. Nothing's lighting it up. Because of it, everything is lit. Right? And try to make it not lit. Try to make consciousness not conscious. Try to make consciousness inert. Try to put a bag over consciousness. Try to imagine consciousness as non-existent. Try to imagine consciousness as not conscious. And all you will experience is consciousness lighting up that imagination. No matter what you do, there's no way that you can move or change or cover consciousness in any way. As a consciousness remains as the stable component to all experience. So the stable, changeless component to all experience. When you look at consciousness in the mind, you see the mind thought after thought after thought. And so there that consciousness is moving around in the mind. Right? It's important to understand because the mind and your perceptions are not away from consciousness. They're not separate from consciousness. They are consciousness. It's just that consciousness doesn't change as the mind changes. Okay, so that's the guhacharam. Nama. This guhacharam, this avihi, this consciousness, which is Brahman, this consciousness, which is moving around the mind, is nama. It is very well known. It is understood. It's understood. This is not something removed from you. It's the conscious being that you are. The only problem is that you have not recognized the independence, the freedom of your consciousness. You think that you've identified yourself with these things that come and go. These things that come and go are not apart from you. Right? Because they all enjoy consciousness. They all are consciousness. But when you identify consciousness with this, and this comes and goes, then you also take yourself to come and go. Right? Mm. So you haven't understood what some might call the paradox. I don't see it as a paradox. Once you know a paradox, it's not a paradox anymore. But once you recognize that all of this is consciousness, right? But consciousness is free of all of this. And you can recognize, I am all of this. This is all me, right? But I am free of all of this. That's the thing to be understood. This has no being apart from me, but my being is independent of this. Understanding your relationship with the mind is paramount to understanding this relationship. That this is dependent on me, I'm not dependent on this. If you can understand it in your mind, then we can go out to the world and understand it in the world. If you can see it in your mind, you can see it in the world. But you have to see it in your mind first. You have to be able to recognize in your mind there is this relationship of the constancy of my being, right? Which these thoughts totally depend on for their being. There isn't a separate being. I am the being of these thoughts. I am the self. I am the substance of these thoughts. Right? But I am also free from these thoughts. These thoughts aren't free from me, but I am completely free from these thoughts. Because these thoughts come and go in me, and I don't come and go. This is what I need to see. This avihi, this Brahman, is Mahatpadam. It is the padam, it is the abode, which is the most exalted Mahatpadam. It is the most exalted abode, because it is the abode, the padam, which everything is rooted in. Right? It is the self of all beings. Right? The conscious being that is the self, the being, the what my mind is rooted in. So look, the pot is rooted in the clay. Okay, my mind is rooted in this self. My body is rooted in the self. My perceptions are rooted in the self. Right. All of my perceptions are rooted in the self. So good, so far, so good. Your body is rooted in the self. Your mind is rooted in the self. Right? The self itself is changeless, non-objectifiable. The bodies, the minds, the sense organs, the perceptions, all of these things are objectifiable. Right? All of these things, the whole creation in fact, all of them have what? For their padam, for their abode. What is the abode for every given thing? Is the avihi, is the self. That's why the self is Brahman. The Brahman means yourself is infinite. Yourself is the one being that is there. Infinite means one without a second. When we say the Atma, Atma means yourself, the conscious being that you are, is Brahman. What that means is that the conscious being that you are is infinite. It is one without a second. There is no other being. It is the being. Yourself is the being. And so now, say if we say that, you're the conscious being that you are, this me, this Swaprakashatvam, the conscious being, that is the stable self, right, which is the self of the mind, that this conscious being, which is non-objectifiable, which is myself, what is it in reference to self of mine? What is it in reference to you? Is myself myself and yourself yourself? Because your bodies are all objectifiable. I can see them and you can see me. So all of these bodies are part of samsara. They're part of the creation. They're part of the manifest creation. But they're part of the dream. If you look at the whole creation as a dream, they're part of the dream. All of our sense organs also are objectifiable. They're also part of the dream. Just like if you have a dream, we all have bodies in the dream, we all have sense organs in the dream, we're all thinking away in the dream. So you have a mind, you have a mind, we have all the minds in the room, we all have minds, they're all objectifiable. They're all part of the dream, they're all known, they all come and go. They're all mithya. Mithya because they come and go. Mithya means a dependent reality. They come and they go. Right? Atma, is Atma objectifiable? Is it one of the objects in the creation? Is yourself one of the objects in the creation for it to come and go? No. The body is, the sense organs are, the mind is, the emotions are, right? The ahankara is, space is, time is, the whole creation is. It's all objectifiable. Is the Atma, is consciousness objectifiable? If consciousness is objectifiable, who's objectifying it? Is there consciousness behind consciousness to objectify the consciousness? Can consciousness be thrown as an object into the world to be looked at? No. Can consciousness be objectified? If you say yes, well, by who? Say consciousness is objectified by who? There is no other consciousness except consciousness to objectify consciousness. You say, well, how can consciousness be known then? Because it's self-evident, because it's consciousness. That's what we mean by avihi. That self-evident consciousness that cannot be objectified, is not an object in the world. And so what makes there two consciousnesses then? How can there be two consciousnesses? It's impossible. Because there's nothing to objectify. You can't objectify it to split it in half. And so, the consciousness, which is Brahman, the Atma, your Atma is Brahman. Why do we say that? Because it's not objectifiable to divide it. And nothing here has any being away from it. That's why we say this consciousness, I am the whole. But because none of this that we perceive has any intrinsic reality apart from the being, which is consciousness. And how am I to divide the consciousness into two? Because non-objectifiable. So what does it mean? It means that the consciousness that I am is the consciousness that you are. There's only one consciousness. And everything is rooted in that consciousness. Everything has its being in that consciousness. Just like this individual mind has its being in consciousness. Consciousness is the being, is the consciousness of the mind. But the consciousness that is the consciousness of the mind is the consciousness of everything. It is the consciousness of your mind, the consciousness of your mind, and the consciousness of perception. There's nothing away from that consciousness. And so now, if you think of it like this, this consciousness which I am, you also are, because what would divide us? Our bodies, which are objectifiable, our sense organs, which are objectifiable, our thoughts, which are objectifiable, our minds, which are objectifiable? No. So there's nothing to divide consciousness. So it's the Mahat Padam, means it is the one, it is the abode, the most exalted abode. Because it is the self of all beings. That's what it means. It is the substance, the being of all beings. If we say, like the clay is the self, the being of the pot. You say consciousness is the self, the being of the creation. Why we have trouble seeing that is because of the Dehatma Buddhi. Because of the extremely understandable, but extreme identification with the body. Because to me, consciousness stops at the body. And then it includes the mind, the sense organs, the body. And then I experience you as out there. And so I experience my reality as an individual walking around in the creation. Right? Experiencing consciousness as being a bubble of consciousness held in this body. But actually, when you analyze and go into the reality of your experience, this simply is not the case. In fact, there is nothing in your perception that's away from consciousness. The whole perception, the perception of the cognition of the mind itself, the thought, the ahankara, the I am thought is in consciousness, right? So that makes the subject. Here you have a mind and your sense organs. That creates the subject. That's consciousness plus the mind. Consciousness plus the I thought, right? So now there's a subject. But now we have consciousness plus the object, right? The object that I'm seeing, like if I'm looking through my eyes at this room, right? Now that's the this, the Adam, the this. So now you have consciousness plus this, or consciousness plus the I thought, or consciousness plus the perception, or consciousness plus the room, or consciousness plus the sound. Right? There is nothing at all that's distant from consciousness. Even if you look now at this room, you have a Dehatma Buddhi. Dehatma Buddhi means identification with the body, the notion that the Atma is the body. But if you look at your experience in the room, you have five sense organs. So just try to be aware as I talk you through this. You have five sense organs. One very powerful one is the sense of touch. Okay? But that is a sense organ. So do you recognize right now as you're sitting in the room that your sense of touch is running through your whole body? Yeah, it's obvious. Okay. Now, you also have the sense of sight, which is allowing you to perceive this whole room. And included in the perception of the room is your body. Okay. So when you just notice that you're seeing this whole room, right? And as you're seeing the room, you're also seeing your body. Through your sense of touch, you're feeling your body, and you're also feeling the chair or the rug that you're sitting on, okay? So that's part of your perception. Any sense of smell that is there, you have that. Any sense of the sound, you have that. Sense of taste, you have that, right? All of these sense organs, right, are now forming a thought modification in your mind. True? If your mind were daydreaming, then you're not doing this little exercise and you just check back in now. You're wondering what the heck we've been talking about. Okay. That's because you require your mind in order to have, right, any knowledge through the sense perception. You actually are experiencing whatever thought is taking place in your mind. That's what you experience. If you're alert and listening to, or using your sense organs, your mind is using your eyes, using your ears, you'll be perceiving what's going on in the room. If you're daydreaming, then your mind, that's where the consciousness is, right? So this is guhacharam, right? The consciousness is there, wherever the mind is. That's where the consciousness is there. Okay? So now, just looking at it in terms of yourself, in terms of the reality of your experience. Okay. The reality of your experience is only consciousness plus whatever thought is there. Do you see that? Because you're using your sense organs to perceive this outside world. That's true. I'm not denying the outside world. I'm just telling you what your experience is. Your experience is whatever the thought modification is giving you. Okay? Should be clear. That thought modification, this guhacharam, that thought modification, whatever it is not any part of it away from consciousness. Not one part of it. The entire vritti, the entire thought modification, is pervaded for consciousness, with consciousness, has consciousness as its being, as itself. True? So now what this means is that actually in your experience, there is not one iota of experience that is not consciousness. That we think that it just shows you how powerful this Dehatma Buddhi is. Because here we have in this three-dimensional room, you've got the wall, the painting which is in consciousness, the room which is in consciousness, the space that is in consciousness, and the body that is in consciousness, the sense organs that are in consciousness, the mind that is in consciousness. There is nothing here. There is no experience at all that is separate from consciousness. But the Dehatma Buddhi is so great that we divide the experience up. That's why you have to slow down for a minute. You have to slow down for a minute and see, well, wait a minute. In fact, I have never had an experience away from consciousness. In fact, the very being of all experience that I have is only consciousness. And then the question is, does this consciousness, which is the very being of the mind, which is capable, which is responsible for all experiences that I have, right? Does this being of my being of consciousness modify or change in any way? That's what we can get rid of. We'll get rid of the world later, the reality of the world later. I want you just to see that this reality of your mind, which has no experience away from consciousness, which really is only consciousness, right? We have to see that, with this experience of, there's no thought that has any being away from consciousness. It is only consciousness. What you need to see now is that this mind that is only consciousness, does the consciousness change as the thoughts change? Right? Does the consciousness change? This is what to look for. You are the consciousness. When the thought goes away, you don't go away. What doesn't go away? Now, if you can notice that, what is it that never goes away? You never go away. Now, look at it like this. If you say, okay, if the thought goes away and I'm still here, that also means this. I am also still here when the thought is here. The thought goes away, I'm here. If the thought is here, I'm here. Nothing happens to me. Now, this comes very profound when you think, when the terrible, bummer, depressed thought is here, the despairing thought is here, I am still here. When the despairing, depressed thought is gone, I'm still here. When the anxious thought is here, I am still here. When the anxious thought is gone, I'm still here. Now, what's really wonderful is next time you have a really terrible thought, and not that I'm wishing it on you, okay, but since they do tend to come, okay, so, okay, next time there's an agitated thought, or you're upset about something, so you're just feeling overwhelmed, you're feeling hurt, you're feeling upset, you're feeling anxious, you're feeling depressed, all of these thoughts that can pass through the mind. Next time that happens, you just notice, am I still here? Am I here? And what am I like? Have I changed? Have I changed? That's an important thing to understand. So that the mind itself gets used to recognizing that no matter what the affect is, no matter what the emotion is, no matter what the perception is, no matter what kind of samsara is going on, you check and see, is my being, has my being changed? Has the I, the self, changed? And you will continuously see, no, it hasn't. No, it hasn't. I'm still here exactly the same way. Okay. Then, this is just a little aside. What causes the mind, when a person starts gaining knowledge, gaining clarity in their vision, for some time, you know, the mind is going to be acting up because of lack of vairagya, lack of dispassion in one area or another. It's like you have such clear understanding, but in certain areas there's still a lot of connection or a lot of attachment where you're just, you know, I need it to be this way to be happy. That conditioning is there. Or I need you to be like this to be happy. Or this has to happen to be happy. You know, I have these areas. Do you have these spots? You know? Or you have a lot of childhood stuff that you're working through. Unconscious material that has to be sorted through. You know? And so, as that stuff is sorting itself out, you know, it is so helpful to have a stable self inside that the mind can have as a refuge. If the mind recognizes that its very being is not going anywhere, is not changing, that being, the conscious being that you are, becomes the refuge for the mind. Because that self is not changing on you. It's not going anywhere. And its nature is wholeness and fullness. And so the mind uses that. It has that whole container to hold it as it's acting out, and then you recognize that the mind is doing this and that because it still thinks it needs this to be happy in order. You know, you slowly pull it back in. You know, you pull it back in and you calm it down and say, you know, that's okay. You'll be okay. You'll be fine. It's all right. You know, you can talk to it and you make it everything settle down because you explain. You know, you're a good parent to the mind. You're a wise teacher. You're a wise teacher. You're a wise and loving teacher and a good parent to all of these parts of the mind that are still growing up and still maturing. And, you know, we have to give our mind that love and that patience, you know. We can so easily, let me put it this way, it's so much easier to do that once we've recognized, you know, that stable center. You can always pull the mind back, or you can always recognize, in spite of the mind going through this problem, I'm still here. That's a real, very, very helpful thing. And so that, he says, after that mahatpadam, let me move on a little bit because I want to elaborate on that a minute. That mahatpadam, that self, which is really the pada, the very, what we call aspada, the very being, the very being of all things. He says, it's atra etat samarpitam, it's mahatpadam, because all of this, etat, this, all of this, is rooted in that. Atra here, in that Brahman, in Brahman, atra, in Brahman, in that. Etat, this, is samarpitam, it is placed in that, it is held by that, it is rooted in that. Shankara says like a spoke is rooted in the hub. All of this has for its being that, it is rooted in that. And then he says, what of all of these things, whether the age it, all the things that are moving, pranat, all things that are breathing, nimishet, cha animishet, all things that are blinking or not blinking, right? In other words, all beings, all creatures, all that is, are rooted in that alone, right? Everything. And then he says, etat janata, may you know this. May you know this. Sat asat. Sat asat. Here, sat means all the things that have form. Asat means all of the things that are formless. Usually we take sat just as satyam and asat as mitya. Here, sat and sat in this context means that all the things that have form and the things that are formless, space and air, have no form. So it's a way of talking about the jagat, the five elements. Some have form, some don't have form. So sat asat usually stands for the entire creation. So this entire creation, all of it is rooted in that. May you know that, which is varenyam, which is the most wanted. Varenyam means if I had a boon, this is the thing that I would most want.
Mm.
That which is the most desirable. The Atma, the Self, is the most desirable because the Self is the one thing that is. And it is the truth. It is that which is. It is your being which is infinite. Sat-chit-ananda. It's the being which will never go away. It's limitlessness itself. And so it is, in fact, what all beings seek, because all beings are seeking themselves. And all of these beings, because of the Dehatma Buddhi, we're seeking ourselves in the creation, trying to become whole, trying to become complete. You know? But the wholeness and completeness is that Mahatpadam, right? Is Brahman itself. And so this is what all beings seek. So you know that, which is this that all beings seek, which is param vijnana prajanam, that which is beyond knowledge of the beings. In other words, vijnana means param vijnana, which is beyond the cognition of all creatures. Means Brahman is not an object of cognition. Brahman cannot be known through an object or as an object of cognition, as a sense object. Because Brahman, it's avihi, that's why avihi is so important. It's self-evident, but it's not an object of cognition. So may you know that Brahman, which is self-evident, which is pure consciousness, which can't be known by any being as an object of cognition. And that which is varishtam, that which is the most exalted. So janata, may you all know that limitless Brahman, which cannot be known as an object of cognition, but which is the very being, located, nothing could be more near. At its sannihitam, nothing could be more near. It's there in the guha, in the buddhi, right, moving around with the vrittis. So that is yourself. Right, that one, so important, that guhacharam, when you say, I am thinking, I am seeing, I am hearing, that's Brahman. That I am seeing, I am hearing, I am thinking, that's Brahman. There's no other Brahman. The problem is that there's an identification with the form rather than with the substance. Because the I am is never changing. So look at, I am seeing, I am hearing, I am thinking, I am talking. I am, I am, I am, I am. That's not changing. Right? The consciousness, I am a conscious being. Conscious being, thinking, hearing, talking. Conscious being is the same, right? And so that conscious being, which is doing all these things, that conscious being is Brahman. You see that? Conscious being that's doing all of these things, thinking, hearing, seeing, talking. It's that conscious being that's abhihita, self-evident. That conscious being is Brahman. Right? That conscious being is the Mahatpadam. It is the one that the whole creation rests in. There is nothing but that consciousness. So that's this verse.
Oh, thank you.
Let's take a minute. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Shut down. I wonder. They're still there. On you know the chant that I was teaching you? I put it on the text section, number 7. You can print it out, but also I have there's an audio, so you can listen to them chanting at the ashram. Did you see it already?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very nice.
This is something sort of like, you know, growing up in the Western, when they would talk about mysticism or the non-dual oneness of all, it seems like that this verse just nails that, you know?
It does.
It doesn't make it a mystery anymore.
Mm-hmm. And all of these verses are doing that. There's a lot of Advaita in this. Upanishad is showing from I am the whole. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
Upanishad.
Yeah, it seems so utterly simple, you know. It's so simple that like the slightest thought makes it complex, or the slightest movement.
It is. It's it could not be more simple. That's the problem.
Yeah.
It's because our minds are complex. We're entangled in duality, you know. But when it's straightened out, it's so basic.
Yes, it's like the anxiety, the mind that has anxiety or the mind that has depression, you know. It's like it's a little difficult for me to stay to be with that and go like, you know, I'm still being. But I have to be, because otherwise I wouldn't know, right?
Right.
It's like that. But afterwards, it's like, I'm still here. And now it's this thought, or whatever that mood is.
That's right.
I mean, it's so utterly simple, but it can be so confusing, you know? I mean, this is exactly what's going on for me. Before I came here, absolute insanity. Really, it gets worse too, you know. The more you get, you know what I mean? I mean relatives like that. You know?
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
And then I said, why am I even going here? Da, da, da. And then I sit here, and then you say that, and it's like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's that simple. That's, you spend a whole lifetime trying to solve the problem.
Yeah. It's another, you know, one of the, when they talk about really the sadhana for Vedanta is shravana.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Mm-hmm. Shravana is that exposure to the teaching. And, you know, you just keep, how then the question comes, you know, how often should I do shravana? Just keep doing shravana until that question isn't there. Really, you keep doing shravana until the question isn't there, and then people keep doing shravana anyway because
they like it. Yeah, why not?
You know, like Swami Vittikatmananda one time, he said, you know, who doesn't enjoy looking at themselves in the mirror? You know, when do you get tired of shravana? You know, and manana has to do with really understanding, giving your mind the opportunity to think it through, what you see at the time of teaching. The teacher thinks it through for you. That's part of the teaching methodology. But then for you to have the freedom to really use your mind, to really understand, to see it. You know, that's the manana. And nididhyasana is that contemplation, which also takes place in shravana. But it's just that owning it up. You know, but why I said that is that samsara, you know, we have lifetimes of samsara. It's beginningless. So samsara we're heavily conditioned. And all our sense organs are meant to only relate to the world, you know. So you couldn't be more conditioned. So you need shravana, you know, to balance it out a little bit. Until the mind gains some strength of understanding. Otherwise, you know, when you walk out the door, it's like... like, you know, like they use an example for it in the Shastra, you know, that if you have, like, you're in a marsh and somebody goes and they pull the you know, the tulis apart, then you see there's water there, you know, but as soon as they lift the hands up, the tulis all go back, you know, and the water's disappeared. And so they use that as an example for the student, you know, you come to the teaching and the shravana is taking place and you, everything is fine and clear and perfect, and then you walk out the door and the tulis is kind of
you're lost again.
Sounds familiar.
I mean, I used to measure how long it would take for the tulis to snap back. And when I used to say, you know, someday I'm going to make it all the way back to my room at the ashram. Because the lecture hall was on one side of the ashram, and then we'd walk up this path. This is in Bombay and Powai. You walk up quite a long ways up a path, and then we got to the ladies' hostel, you know. And so I used to get out. By the time I'd get out the door of the lecture hall, the tulis would... I'd just feel my mind, you know, go back, close. And it would have been so... beautiful. And then I remember thinking, someday I'll make it all the way back to my room. And then I remember the day I made it all the way back to my room. I remember that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Meaning that it never closed again?
No, it did close. It took a while before but at least I got back to my room.
This verse doesn't, the word Brahman doesn't actually appear in it.
It doesn't, it's a to this, because it's implied from its previous, it's carried over from the previous.
Yeah. Now, I have this sort of original, one of the original questions I used to have was how Vedanta addresses that consciousness is not a product of the brain, and I think the way it's tackled is through, you know, you break things into smaller pieces and you say, well, there's nothing there, so what is going to produce? You know, there's only form, and how is to break form, and there's nothing, really. But that same brain that does not produce consciousness does produce thought. That does produce, you know, all the thoughts, right? So there's this matter.
Okay.
That produces thought.
Okay.
Which is completely with consciousness always, because consciousness is always there. But is there anything that addresses, you know, how this thing that is sula, that's matter, will produce thought, but it doesn't produce consciousness? You know, the brain produces thought, but...
See, what we have to do then is to, what we're trying to do is get to them.
God bless you. Maybe we should end
this. No, sorry. We'll end, but let me do this first. It's just a cold. No, I'm fine. Now we have to get to this question then. Is the brain matter?
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You say yes, it's matter. What is matter? What is it? Now we have to look at matter itself and see if we can find any matter in matter.
Mm-hmm.
And what you'll find is that there is no such thing as matter. There is only consciousness. So the physical brain itself is only consciousness. This physical body is only consciousness. This table is only consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing but consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the complexity of the creation, you know, we make a division between subtle, like the subtle mind and the physical body, and consciousness. But actually, there is no matter. There's only consciousness.
Right. I guess my question was more, you know, that is true and that's how it's tackled. But if you look at the thought,
yeah,
you know, you don't say thought is matter and thought is not there.
No. Yeah.
There and it's produced from that matter.
Yeah, but then we make a distinction between the brain and thought as being more subtle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so then we have a subtle world, and then we have a physical world, and the physical brain produces the subtle thought,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can even say, well, these subtle thoughts really, they're nothing but energy, right? They're nothing but synapses firing in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
You can say all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But then those synapses firing, or those thoughts that are produced, or those the brain waves that are being experienced, all are known because of consciousness. So you can't get behind consciousness, and you can't get away from consciousness. So no matter what you're looking at or what you're analyzing, are you looking to the brain to try to find some consciousness? Is the brain producing consciousness? Well, consciousness can never be objectified in order to find it, right? But you can find synapses and things that are producing thoughts,
right?
You know, but thoughts are different than consciousness. Thoughts are known. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I was going by, you know, what the common understanding in the world is, that, you know, there are separate consciousnesses. There is a consciousness that can observe your mind and your thoughts and your consciousness. So there can be a fear scene. There can be a subject-object there. You know,
oh, sure. I mean,
the kind of normal way.
Yeah, but that's normal, isn't it? Like, say you have a dream, and there's a scientist in the dream. There's a great scientist in the dream. This great scientist is discovering some of the mathematical laws and equations that make up the relationships of the dream world, and is discovering things about how the brain works and how the mind works and all
mm-hmm.
of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But everything that he is discovering
mm-hmm.
exists within that maya.
Mm-hmm.
Now what that scientist has to become a mumukshu. And then what he will discover, that everything that he is discovering, including himself, the one who is discovering it,
mm-hmm.
is nothing but that the substance there is only consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
that there is. But see, if you look at what science is discovering anyway, they're not finding anything solid here. Say you put all of this into a microscope. There's nothing solid here. There's more space than anything else. You know, so it depends on what level you're talking on. Even if you're looking at the brain as something, as a real object, we have the object, the brain. But if you put this object, the brain, under a microscope, you know, you have, you know, again, atoms and quarks and lots of space and, you know, energy.
And yet it produces thoughts.
Yeah. But so what?
So, no, I'm saying if you extend that, you can say, well,
No. Because, look, say, I'm not even talking about the subtle body, I'll just keep it with that. Say the brain produces thought. We say the thought is known. Right? So the thought itself is not consciousness, because the thought comes and goes. The thought is known. So the inert brain, say now we look at the whole Maya as inert, Samatha, removing consciousness from Maya. The inert brain produces an inert thought. Okay? There's nothing wrong with that. Inert brain produces an inert thought. It's just that when we go and analyze the inert brain and the inert thought, we find there is nothing inert. There, in the end, that we find is only consciousness.
How can an inert brain produce an inert thought?
What I mean by that is the brain, if you take the brain as, the brain, which is matter, okay, produces a thought. So Kiki was saying that thought is conscious. The inert brain, matter, the brain, which is matter, produces a thought, which is conscious, right? But I'm not accepting that. I'm saying if the brain is matter and it produces a thought, which is subtle matter, the brain, which is matter, physical matter, produces a thought, which is subtle matter. So we want to say that. Both are matter. Why do we say both are matter? Because both are objectifiable. Okay? Now we have matter, subtle matter and brain matter. We're calling it matter. But when we analyze this matter, we find there's no matter there. Because everything is infinitely divisible. You can't find anything there. So what ends up to being the self of matter is consciousness. So actually there is no such thing as matter, there's only consciousness. That's why we have to go into the very being of the creation that we experience, these names and forms that we experience, to discover, is there any name and form that doesn't resolve itself or have for its ultimate substance just consciousness? There can't be, because there can't be anything matter, because in the end, you can't find the matter that you're seeking, because everything that you call as matter is actually a conglomerate of smaller little clumps of matter, right? Everything you call as a form, for instance, is just a conglomerate of smaller forms. I use this lamp as an example all the time. And so say you get to the very smallest form, and you're trying to find out what is the matter, you know, that is the stuff of that form. What is the matter of it? So you get to the very smallest form. Problem is, it's still a form, and you have to take that form off to get to what's inside of it, you know. If it's a form, it's divisible. You have to get to the insides of it. So in the end, what is the inside of the form is formless, non-objectifiable. So what is there all along is just the very being of the form. And that being of the form is consciousness. That's what it is.
This is something I thought I heard you say something which is pretty clear about that. That if you see the, you know, in the thought, if you see that the thought is made up of consciousness, you know, that if you see that, then you can see it in the creation too. You said something like that.
Well, it goes like this. Mm-hmm. If you can recognize what I call the satyam mithya, mm-hmm. relationship between consciousness and your mind, that the mind has no being apart from consciousness. Then you recognize that in your whole experience of this world, right, there is no distance between consciousness and your experience of the world. Okay? Then we go to say, well, this world, of course, in reference to my mind, you know, it's I only consciousness pervades it, because really conscious, but in my experience, consciousness pervades it because it's pervading the vritti, the thought modification. But what about this world? Does it have a reality different than consciousness? And then we have to go and look at the nature of the world itself, of name and form itself, mm-hmm. to find out if there's any substance there.
So it's not just like automatic that if you recognize the satya mitya in relation to thoughts, that you will automatically recognize that.
No. But once you recognize that satya mitya in relationship to the thought, and then you can recognize, because it goes two, like this. First you recognize, and there's other ways, but this way is one. You recognize the constancy of yourself, of your own being, to present to the thought. And that the thought has no substance away from your being. And that as it go, your thoughts go on changing, you consciousness remains the same. You see that, okay? Then you recognize that actually when you're looking out at this room, that there is nothing. So this is a good meditation, open-eye meditation. When you're looking at the room to see, is consciousness contained in the body? Is your being, the me, your own presence, contained in the body? Because actually, when you're sitting here, you're looking at the room, the whole room, right, is in consciousness. So where's the me located now? So you should just relax, you know, sit kind of relaxed and just allow yourself to experience the room or the outdoors, and then just ask yourself, okay, this whole experience, true vritti, the whole experience is in consciousness. Where's the me, this me, the conscious me, located? It's not located in the body. So that's a good meditation to recognize that over and over, that your me is not located in the body. Okay, then, once you recognize, okay, the me, the myself, I'm not located in the body, you know, this whole thing exists in me. That's in my experience. The whole thing exists in me. I'm everywhere here. You know, I'm everywhere and not expansive. You have to see in your own experience what I mean by that. Then, when you recognize that yourself is not contained. Consciousness is not contained. It's not objectifiable. It's not contained. Then, that's freedom. Yourself is free. It's a sangha. Then you start looking at these objects, which you've taken to be so real, like this and this, and analyze them and see, do they have any substance? And as you start taking them apart, the substance remains changeless, which is the very being, the very existence that they're all enjoying. That existence is non-objectifiable, but it's the very substance of all that is. That non-objectifiable substance is me, is a self. So those are, you know, things that you kind of can see in class, but then when you're walking around, it's a good to just see it all the time as you're walking around, as you're talking with friends.
It seems easy to see that your mind is in consciousness, but it doesn't seem so easy to see. It's, you know, like the vritti are in consciousness, and the knowledge of the objects is brought to you ultimately, you know, through vritti, and the vritti is in consciousness. But I guess that it's still hard for me to see that the objects themselves are in consciousness.
Okay, but wait.
Separate from the, without the mind or something.
Well, don't worry, Rob, for the time being, don't worry so much about a separate object. If you can start out just trying to recognize that, all right, now with your eyes open, you have a thought modification of the room, okay? And that room, which you're experiencing, which is really a thought modification, is in consciousness, right? So now, if you can just stick with that for the time being, what you recognize is that the whole room, including your body, is in consciousness, is in you. Not that you are in your body aware of the room. Right? So, if you can use that as a meditation to recognize that, because if you recognize that at that time, you're recognizing the asangaha. Asangaha means that you're not attached to anything, that your being is free. And your self is not located in the body. Right? It's rather that this whole vritti, the whole thought modification, the whole experience is located in you. You are the self of the whole experience. See? So that's experiential. So to sit and recognize that. Then when we go to deconstructing, or whatever word we want to use, taking apart the universe to show that it has no being apart from that, that's easier. So don't worry about that external self right now. Even when you say, if you read Swamiji's section on this verse that we did, he has a little tiny bit on this. When you have a thought, there's the conscious being, me, and the thought. That thought is divided into subject and object. I know the object. Like, here I am. This is a thought. I'm identified with the mind and the body. That's the subject. And everything else is the object. So we have object consciousness and subject consciousness. Right? Actually, consciousness illumines the subject, body, mind, sense organs, and the object. And so we think of subject conscious as an object consciousness. But really, there's consciousness that illumines the subject and the object. And that's what you need to just relax and let yourself see the truth of that. You know? I should stop. Mm-hmm. Yeah.